switching to solar energy may not be as green as it seems. Many of the newest solar panels are made with NF3, a gas that's much more potent than carbon dioxide in contributing to global warming. With me now for today's Underreported is Michael Prather, professor at UC Irvine. Earlier this year, he wrote a paper for the journal Geophysical Research Letters. Now Foreign Policy magazine is calling the NF3 issue one of the top 10 missed stories of 2008. Welcome to our show.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Did I say something that amused you?
The top 10 missed stories. The NF3 story is a great, I will say, scientific triumph of discovery by several people in working the problem. It's interesting that it's one of the great unreported ones.
Well, it didn't get much press. Why do you think that is?
It was a funny compound because it was a very niche compound until people started making flat screens and solar panels. And as you point, one of the new types of solar panels uses this gas. And a lot of our flat-screen LCD panels use this gas in production.
iPhones as well, I hear?
I think some of the iPhone panels may. I'm not sure. It's basically used for fairly large-scale processing. So the chambers they make this silicone or the LCDs in would be meters across.
Mm-hmm.
It's made for large, so that's mainly panels and big LCD displays. And it's a key gas for both cleaning and etching. It's used to release fluorine in the compound very effectively. The problem with it is that technology comes with a price, and I think this is a case where the industry fell asleep at the controls.
Well, what is NF3, and how was it even created in the first place?
Well, originally, nitrogen trifluoride is synthetic. We know of no natural sources. There doesn't appear to be any in ice cores or background that we have identified. It's a fairly low abundance gas in the atmosphere. And it's a rather neat one because it can be shipped in basically flasks and sent to manufacturing facilities. These are primarily around on the Asian side of the Pacific Rim, and Taiwan and Japan and Korea and China. And it's safe. Then you put it in a chamber and you zap it, and you can release fluorine atoms. And the fluorine atoms are what's needed for the chamber cleaning and for the etching.
Does the NF3 remain in the final product, or is it only used in the manufacture?
None of it stays in the product. So, you know, in some sense, the panels you're getting are all clean. They have no threat. It's the process of their manufacture that's the critical issue. And one of the companies was bragging that this compound was never released. And because it was never listed in the Kyoto Accord, because it wasn't really produced much in 1995 and 96 when they were looking at all the gases that could contribute, it never got listed. And so it only came to attention recently as production's sort of been doubling every year for the past few years. And that's why we brought it to attention, saying this stuff is leaking. Air Products, the manufacturer, said, oh, no, 99% is destroyed because they have to actually catch it. Not all will be destroyed in the chamber, and then they have to actually recombust it on the exit. And so it's a very slippery gas. You have to basically get it down to liquid nitrogen temperatures to catch it, or you can combust it at very high temperatures. It's a not highly reactive gas, so it slips out.
How does it compare to carbon dioxide, which typically gets the blame for climate warming effects?
Well, to be fair, there's sort of how do you look at it? It was 17,000 times more powerful than CO2 per gram emitted. Okay,
but there's a lot less of it, of course.
But the amount that's emitted is trivial compared to the total CO2. And so in terms of how much we might be emitting of NF3, you might compare the total NF3 production to a very large coal-fired power plant, depending on how much leaks. Okay, and so that's a reasonable comparison. There are many big coal-fired power plants, but a big coal-fired power plant is still a fairly massive operation. You know, it's putting out 25 million metric tons of CO2 a year. For example, the big Scherer plant in Georgia is one of our big 3,600 megawatt coal-fired power plants. It's pumping out about 25,000 megawatts a year. We're producing, in terms of NF3, about 75 million metric tons a year. And so the question is, of that 75, how much actually gets into the atmosphere? And so the solar panels we make with it, the key issue is catching it during the manufacture, and you can't catch all of it, and so some of it will leak. And my colleagues, after we wrote our paper, my colleagues down in Scripps in San Diego, Ray Weiss, went out and said, we can measure it, which we said it's got to be measured. And they measured it, and certainly it's in the atmosphere, and it's growing, and the stuff is leaking out during the manufacture.
And it's the concern is that it is being used in products that are going to be manufactured in greater quantity over time. LCD screens are becoming more and more popular, and as we said, solar panels are something that everybody agrees would be a very positive thing in the future.
And I think, and if you actually look at the solar panel and look at probably the amount that leaks, solar panels are still worth their weight, okay? The key issue that what we bring up from the science side is that you should not forget that all technology has a cost, and you need to find out what that cost really is. And this is a case where the manufacturers were basically complaining that, no, there is no cost, it's a free gas, you know, we capture all of it. And we say, you've got to go out and measure it in the atmosphere because that's the proof of what gets out. And the latest measurements from my colleagues down in San Diego, Weiss and Company, I think demonstrated that probably the leakage rate's running maybe 10-20%.
That much. So
that much. And it can be, there are many ways to do it. We've talked with other people in industry, and it can be caught. And so I think this is just a wake-up call saying we need to make sure that we scrub the exhaust better and catch it.
Now, is there an irony in the fact that this replaced another chemical that we decided we didn't want to live with, PFCs?
Right. The perfluorocarbons, like CF4, were used initially, and that was even harder to catch and burn than NF3 was. And so Air Products got a great award in 2002 for this new gas, but there may be even better products to deliver fluorine, you know, to make flat panel displays and to make solar, make our solar panels that we're going to need. And so this does not mean we should not buy solar panels. What it means is we should go after the manufacturing process, quantify, you know, what the greenhouse gas cost is of NF3, and decide if it's worth it, and if decide whether or not you can capture more of it and destroy it.
But you've suggested that the manufacturers are denying that there's a problem.
They kept saying, one manufacturer is denying a problem. Others know this, and others are working on various options around it. So I'd say all the manufacturers, once it's raised to the issue, you say, hey, this gas cannot be leaked. Why? Because it's exceedingly potent greenhouse gas. If we can get the leakage rates down very small, then it becomes negligible, and we've succeeded in our goals. And I think this is just a wake-up call that we can go measure in the atmosphere and see what the leakage is. And then we can say, okay, you have to do something about the manufacturing process.
On your biographical page on the UC Irvine website, it lists one of your research interests as simulation of the physical, chemical, and biological processes that determine atmospheric composition.
Yes. A mouthful.
How do you simulate those processes?
Well, one of the reasons I was interested in the nitrogen trifluoride story was we build models of the atmosphere where we try to simulate clouds, convection, sunlight, the chemistry that goes on in the stratosphere, the chemistry that goes on near the ground, and put these gases in and find out how long they reside in the atmosphere. So one of our projects for the paper was to recalculate the lifetime of this gas as to how long it would survive in the atmosphere, which is relevant for its greenhouse impact. And so we had to update the lifetime by following, you know, the NF3 molecules through the atmosphere until they get in the stratosphere where they're destroyed.
Do they also accumulate in the oceans as carbon dioxide does?
They will, and there's actually a lot of people working very interestingly on some of our synthetic greenhouse gases are now building up in the ocean to a level where it's become a reservoir. And we don't think they're destroyed, but we have to realize that that's a reservoir that's going to take a long time to clear out also. You know, sort of like building up a secondary reservoir that holds things. We have that already, for example, for the chlorofluorocarbons that destroy ozone. We have large reservoirs of those in the landfill. They're in the foam. The banks we have, you know, all the landfills, a fairly large bank, for example, of chlorofluorocarbon 11.
My guest is Michael Prather, professor at UC Irvine, author of a paper for the journal Geophysical Research Letters Foreign Policy magazine is calling one of the top 10 missed stories, news stories of 2008, and we've decided to include it on Underreported today. We didn't want to miss it here. Now, NF3 was developed to replace PFCs. Is there something else out there that'll be safe to replace the NF3, or is it just a matter of being more careful in the manufacture and capture?
I think there are two. Both, I'll answer yes. There are companies I know out there trying to produce different sources of fluorine that would not be associated with major greenhouse gases. We've talked with them quietly. And there are also companies that think they can do a better job on capture and making sure that very small fractions escape. So I think both ways are possible. What I'm proud of my colleagues for measuring it to get that leakage rate and for us for raising it is that we've actually closed the science circle and we're saying, hey, you can do something about it, and it's an incentive to go solve the problem. It's not the biggest threat to climate change. That's CO2. This is one of those little things that you want to recognize still has a cost.
Do you think it's likely it'll be added to the list of regulated greenhouse gases in the Kyoto Protocol's second commitment period beginning in 2012?
I think it's likely because the reason it was missed in the first place was in 1995-96 was when we were doing the IPCC report. And I remember writing the chapter on the chemistry then, and NF3 was not in the chapter on the chemistry as a greenhouse gas. In 2001, it was. And then in 2002, production started ramping up. So all of Kyoto is based on 1995. For the second commitment period, they're going to start looking at what's new and what's changed.
Once something is added to the Kyoto list, then what? How long before it's better regulated?
Well, what I'm not so worried about the regulation as the reporting. I think what we need is solid knowledge on how much of that material is actually being made, produced, and estimates of release. Once we actually get good reporting on it, then you can actually make a decision whether or not it's important enough to regulate.
Well,
I won't say it's important enough to regulate. For me, it's important enough to get good knowledge from the reporting from the companies.
Whenever anything like this comes up, there are always some scientists who are brought out on the other side saying that this is not really a major concern. Are there scientists saying that NF3 is not a concern?
Well, we originally had a fair scientific dispute with my colleagues, who Robeson, there's a paper for us that claimed that the release rate was small. They looked at the process. They claimed that not much was getting out. We said production's ramping up. We cannot believe the release rate's that small during the full life cycle. Life cycle meaning you manufacture it, it leaks then. You put it in containers, some leaks. When you finish the containers, they still have 10 to 15% in there. You have to make sure it doesn't leak out of them when you ship the containers back to the company that then has to pump them out and refill them. So there's all sorts of life cycle leakage, and we had a battle with them in the literature. But then it got resolved by what we said, it has to be measured. And so my friends in Scripps went down and measured it and said, no, it's leaking, you know, at a given rate. So I think that's the big issue, that, you know, science can close the cycle. What we need now is better reporting from the companies. EPA has NF3 listed as a voluntary. I don't think any company is going to put in a voluntary reporting list they're required to do it. So,
on a previous segment, the one that preceded you, we talked with an academic who's done a study into whether liberal professors are affecting their students. And he said that the major change in academia, as far as politics is concerned, is that mathematicians and scientists are tending to be more liberal than they were in the past. And it's partly, he felt, because of being disillusioned with the way government has dealt with big issues like stem cell research and the like, and something like this as well. Have you found that to be true in your science department?
The people I work with on global change issues, environmental change, climate change, are somewhat, I'm not sure they're becoming more liberal, but they're somewhat depressed at the lack of government action to deal with what they see as clear environmental degradation. Okay, now does that make them more left? I don't know. What we haven't seen, and we have seen clearly a policy that says we're not going to act. We have not seen anything like the stem cell research or what NIH has seen in terms of science boards being arbitrarily adjusted. So our community has seen a public resistance to act, and that's at least public. What I haven't seen in the climate change is the level of replacing people, you know, on science advisory boards.
Often resistance has to do with economics, and right now solar panels are not all that economic to produce as it is.
Right.
In fact, without subsidies, the Germans who produce so many of them would probably stop producing them. If we stop using NF3, do you think it would make it even less likely that people would want to make these things?
I think that there are probably ways to either replace NF3 with another gas or to do a slightly better job on capture that probably would look at a cost of a few percent or maybe even a savings. I don't think this is a major cost issue on making these because I think it's not something you have to stop right now. It's something you have to plan what is the next generation for making these solar panels.
And what kind of gases are out there that are promising?
Oh, as I said, I've heard from various companies that the key issue is the ability to deliver fluorine. So any gases that you can pump in that are relatively you can get through the system, that then you can plasma discharge or radiate to basically release fluorine atoms, is what's needed to work on the silica. And so I think there's several people coming up with approaches, or there's several ways to clean up the exhaust stream and make sure that you do combust it.
Now we start.
You can burn this stuff, but the question is, if you're running a plant flat out, one of the papers noted that if you're under pressure to produce, you flush the system faster.
We began with you being amused at the fact that this was chosen one of the top 10 missed stories of 2008 by Foreign Policy magazine, but it is. And were you surprised that it didn't get more attention?
I think it's a great scientific story of success of identifying something and actually somebody closing it off by the later paper this year that measured it. I think it's a great scientific closure of understanding. I never think of it as a major impact on the climate change system.
It's we have to leave it there.
Okay.
Michael Prather is a professor at UC Irvine. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.